Broadcasting to New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Sydney, London, and around the world, this is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for listening to Trumpet Radio Live here. This is the Tuesday edition. A lot to talk about in today's program. Europe's oldest living inhabitant has been discovered. We'll talk about what that is. Back to school time means some trouble. Albuquerque teachers told not to identify the children as boys or girls. There's a theme park out in Kentucky that deals with events from the Bible. It's quite popular. And then also, what about the end of your life? Is it better to keep on trying to live or to let nature take its course without medical intervention? We'll take a look at that story coming up, all on today's edition of Trumpet Radio Live.
This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Welcome to Trumpet Radio Live, this Tuesday edition. Dwight Falk and Grant Turgeon here today. And it's kind of a muggy day outside today. Did you notice that, Grant?
Not too much. I was in so much of a rush. I guess I am feeling it now that I've come inside.
Yeah, it's got one of those balmy sort of feels to it out there. You'd almost, if you close your eyes and imagine, you'd almost think you're at the beach.
If only.
If only. You know, we took a trip to the beach a couple of years ago in California, and my daughter was really impressed, and she's pretty young. And so she's always trying to, she wants to play things, you know, as kids do. Dad, do you want to play? And she'll just make something up. And I'm never sure what the rules are. There don't appear to be any, but, you know, apparently we can just go on with our normal routine, but we're playing something. So anyway, but she'll say, Dad, do you want to play beach?
Wow.
And I'm like, yes. What do we do? You know, I'm not sure what we do, but we're playing beach. So I'm going to play beach today while awesome. I'm on the air, because it feels like it could be a climate where we're near the ocean today. Hopefully it's nice where you are. A lot of listeners around the world at kpcg.fm, and we appreciate you joining us. A lot to talk about today, as mentioned in the intro. We've got some headlines to get to, Key of David program and the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. And then interesting write-up about some health concerns that are going on, as well as this biblical theme park that's out there in Kentucky. It's kind of interesting. So Grant's got more information on that for us coming up here in just a little bit. A couple of the headlines for today, though, that are kind of interesting. Yesterday we talked about this lady in China that is 119, and she wants to live, I guess, to be the oldest person. Never mind that. There's something older in Europe. Adonis.
What?
But it's a tree.
Oh.
Adonis, Europe's oldest living inhabitant. They say Europe's oldest living inhabitant goes by the name of Adonis. I think of that pro wrestler from years ago. lives in the highlands of northern Greece and is over 1,075 years old. So that's amazing when you think about what's happened in the last 1,075 years. It's a tree, of course. The millennium-old Bosnian pine was discovered by a group of scientists from Stockholm University, the University of Mainz, and the University of Arizona, who announced their findings on Friday. That's pretty impressive, and it's the oldest one that they know of in Europe. But they say it still lags a few thousand years behind the world's oldest living tree. That distinction belongs to a bristlecone pine in the White Mountains of California, which they think is over 5,000 years old. But Adonis, they say, would have witnessed its fair share of history, and I think that's probably what a lot of people think of when you think of something being that old, like what would have, you know, happened during that time. And they say it would have seen the Byzantine Empire at its peak, as well as the subsequent rise and fall of the Ottoman Empire. The tree was 100 years old when Macbeth was crowned King of Scotland and was 750 years old when Isaac Newton formulated his laws of motion. So, you know, they always say, like, if these walls could talk or whatever. if that bark could talk, what would it tell us?
It's funny that it says this tree has witnessed, even though it has no recollection of what may have happened, no comprehension of the events. But yeah, it was around. So who knows if some people etched their name in it and it over time faded away.
Yeah, that's true. People, it's interesting to think about what would have happened right at that location over the years. I had a, I think it was a biology teacher in my freshman year in high school, and he was, I really liked him. He was a unique guy, and he said that when he died, he wanted somebody to stick an apple in his mouth and bury him so that he would turn into a tree. I don't think he literally, but he just wanted to be part of this tree and keep living and giving apples to people, I guess.
Yeah, it seems like that would be, well, it's kind of a gruesome visual for me. I mean, the roots would have to pop out of his mouth at some point.
Yeah. Yeah, it'd be very interesting. You know, actually, speaking of that, there was kind of a gruesome discovery fairly recently, I think. There was this write-up about things that weather reveals. Like a storm will come through, it'll tear things up, and all of a sudden you come out and you find something. You know, and you think, well, where did this come from? That happened. There was a tree that got knocked over, and there was a human skeleton in the roots.
Oh.
Because they had obviously been buried, and the tree grew down, and it just got in there. So they came out and the tree was toppled over. There was a human there.
Wow.
So that's pretty weird.
There's so much beneath the surface. I mean, who knows what's right underneath this building right now?
It's scary to think about.
Dogs bury a lot of interesting things all over the place too.
That's right.
They're always digging holes and hiding things.
Yeah. There's all sorts of things. I've been reading this one book about some people around the World War II time period, and they were talking about how they buried everything because they wanted to go back later, you know, food, valuables, because if they didn't bury it, it would be taken, it'd be stolen. And so that stuff's probably around somewhere.
Wow.
You know, and probably not too deep unless somebody, you know, has dug it up. But throughout history, yeah, people, they want to bury things that they want to find later. And, you know, what's that character in that Ice Age movie, that little squirrel? He's always, yeah. I think of him because he's always trying to find that acorn he's chasing around.
And the worst possible things always happen to him.
So if you're trying to bury something and find it later, it's kind of like that guy.
That seems
hard
like
time finding it.
Yeah, something buried underground, that would be the biggest motivation to have X-ray vision, I think. I mean, I don't really care to see through walls. I want to see underground and all the things that are underneath our feet that we have no idea are even there.
Yeah, some people really, really like metal detecting. You know, they go out on the beach or go in an area, and a lot of times can find some pretty, pretty interesting things. So there is a lot out there that's happened over the history of man, and it's buried down in the layers. That's why archaeology is so fun. People
exactly.
really like that. Or, of course, kids, you always think of maps and treasure, and you know, that's like a dream come true to have something like that.
Yeah, those kids who grow up playing in the sandbox are probably the same ones who as adults, they're the archaeologists.
Yeah.
They've just always been so interested in that, more than most. I think everyone is interested in that to a certain extent.
Yeah, finding something neat from years ago, it's always a kind of interesting idea. School time is starting up again for a lot of different school districts, and it's interesting because just the different rules and laws and changing society, it's affecting school. This headline says, some Albuquerque teachers told not to use boys and girls when referring to students. An Albuquerque elementary school is raising eyebrows after an assistant principal told teachers to stop calling students boys and girls. KOB-TV in Albuquerque reports a Carlos Rey Elementary School assistant principal sent teachers a letter ordering them to no longer refer to students as boys and girls starting this month. The Gender Identity Procedural Directive. That's what it's called. What a weird name. Can you get out your Gender Identity Procedural Directive book? Of course. Also told teachers to eliminate gender in their classrooms.
Come on.
Unbelievable. Albuquerque Public Schools says the assistant principal made a mistake and she was immediately addressed for the overreach. So you see this happen sometimes where there's something pretty controversial. A statement is made about it. As they say, eyebrows are raised, and they say, well, it was an overreach. But they keep pushing that.
Yeah.
How can the kids just learn about reading and writing and arithmetic, gender identity? I mean, is this happening? It's like we're in a bad dream.
Yeah, I heard a girl recently, or a woman recently, say when she was a child, she wanted to be a flower, but it didn't mean that she knew what she was talking about. This is the age when the kids really, they just don't. They don't know anything. I mean, maybe they go through a quick phase where boys like girly things or vice versa. I mean, a lot of girls consider themselves tomboys for a long time. Doesn't mean they should identify that way. I think it's funny to contemplate just how many people we would trigger just because we have no concept of the 63 or however many gender identities there are.
Yeah, that's always confused me because I thought there's only two.
Yeah.
And then when there's all these extra ones, I'm like, well, what are those?
Yeah, so. I've been trying to figure it out recently. I've listened to a few of those women who try to explain it, but apparently they think that gender and sex are two different things. So, yeah, there's two different sexes, male and female. Mm. But I guess gender has to do now with whatever's in your mind.
I gotcha. I gotcha. Okay. So well, we're learning things today.
You could be an attack helicopter in your mind, though.
That's true.
Pretty out there stuff.
Hey, well, I tell you what. When I was in grade school, there was a group of kids that really liked cars and trucks. They were that kind of into that. They liked the idea of monster trucks, you know, the ones that would drive over other cars. And so what they played at recess, while most of us played like football and kickball, there was a group that played pretended they were trucks. And they ran around in a line. I kid you not. And they would run around in a line and just be trucks. Mm-hmm. And I don't think they were identifying gender-wise as an automobile. I think it was just a game. I think everyone moved on with life.
Right.
I did watch them at a distance and think, that's bizarre. But that's what they liked. They were having fun. They were pretending. But no one stopped and said, wait a second now. We need to really look at this. Maybe this is how they identify. At that moment, they did identify as trucks.
Yeah, it's really no different from the way that we're trying to push all these different gender identities on children today. I mean, it's like however they feel is what they are. So shouldn't that extend beyond even a human gender definition at some point? Because that's how ridiculous it already is.
That's where it's going. It's like, where is it going to end up? It just gets to be very convoluted. It's but so anyway, people in Albuquerque are having to deal with some of that. I don't know how you would refer to the kids. I guess just as some sort of neutral, hey thing.
They have all those new pronouns they made up, like Zay and Zim.
Right.
Whatever that means. That's just total, absolute nonsense.
Yeah, I think you could almost make a living just going around and waiting for like the new term, like Zay and Zim, and then being offended by that somehow and starting like an anti-that campaign. Yeah. So you have to have a new term.
You could rally a lot of people to the cause.
Oh, sure.
We always talk about that. People don't even understand the causes they get behind. But as long as they're behind a cause, it gives them a little bit of a purpose at least. And people always want to think that they matter and what they're doing has, you know, meaningful consequences.
I should contact those guys from grade school and see if they want to start like a club where we all identify as vehicles.
Maybe they already do.
Maybe
they've already been nurtured to think that way.
It might be out there. I don't know. Really strange. Also in California, they're having some interesting situations. Hundreds of California children sent home on the first day of school due to new vaccination law. Scores of California students may be sent home on their first day of school because of a new vaccine law that took effect this year. The new state law took effect July the 1st. Now parents can no longer use personal or religious beliefs as a reason not to have their kids immunized. Mm. This year, kindergartners and seventh graders must show proof of immunizations. Monday was the first day of school for kids in Oakland. Hundreds of them were expected to be sent home. They said there could be a few hundred kids that are not immunized, and so we'll be encouraging them as quickly as possible to get out of there, said Oakland Unified School District John Zaski. The parents may try to drop them off, and we'll have to turn them away. Young children who got their personal belief exemptions approved before January 2016 will be grandfathered in. According to the new law, they still must get immunized when they reach seventh grade. So it's there are a lot of strong feelings about this. I read the comments to the article, and most of them were very strongly against being forced into immunization. It's an interesting topic.
That's just another method of religious persecution. I never got immunized. I think it was for religious reasons as well. There are a lot of people who would feel discriminated against for that. It's amazing if you just think of all the people who are trying to avoid discriminating against now. But there's no concern about that when it comes to religion anymore. I mean, if you are not with the latest social cause and it's because of your religion, you deserve endless persecution, it seems like.
Well, and there's a story that we'll talk about later about some of the end-of-life options for older people. There's a write-up in the Washington Post about people that are, you know, quite a ways on in age, in this case in their 80s, and the medical profession trying to force them to live longer, but in most cases, if they do something invasive to live longer, their life is quite miserable. And he has an example of his own father, and his father wished that he had just let it go its natural course, mm-hmm. with a little bit of help just to kind of, you know, deal with the problem. But so it's interesting looking at that, and then looking at the immunization. You have two sides of the age scale, and as this author in the Washington Post brings out, he's talking about a book that highlights some of what the medical profession thought was the way to go years ago. And they found out it's ridiculous. You would never want to do these practices.
Mm-hmm.
So here we are today. And everyone, of course, always thinks, well, we've got it all figured out now.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of controversy out there about immunizations. Do they cause problems? You know, there's people have very strong opinions on both sides of it. And, you know, whatever, that's for somebody else to get into, I guess. But just the fact that they're being forced to do it, there's a religious freedom issues. There's even just the freedom to say, I don't want to be part of this. I mean, to be forced into something in this country, it's interesting. You really have to go back and look at what the laws of the land are.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because on one hand, you know, if you are, say, going into a certain profession and they say, well, look, you can't work at this company unless you fulfill these certain things. And if you go into the medical profession, you need to be immunized. So, okay, if you don't want to be immunized, what's the consequence? Well, you don't work in that profession, right, or something. It's a private business. I guess it is what it is. There's mm-hmm. probably some legal laws, or I don't know what they all are. But this is a public school, and it's funded by taxpayer dollars. But if you don't follow the immunization protocol, you can't have your kid go to that school. Do you still have to pay taxes? I mean, like, there's a few questions. Yeah. And then one of the commenters even said, do the illegal students coming to the school have to be immunized? I mean, I don't know. But there are cases of illegals coming in that have tuberculosis that is drug resistant.
Wow.
But they're coming in. I mean, there are stories about that. So on one hand, there's this really strong, you must be immunized. And on the other hand, people have tuberculosis. So... lots of questions.
Yeah, there definitely should be a distinction between the public and private sectors. If you're a private sector business, you can kind of enforce the laws you want to. But when it comes to the public sector, yeah, you're right. These people are paying taxes to support these schools, and yet their kids are getting sent home because they weren't immunized, which was a perfectly legal option until just now, I guess. I mean, that should cause a lot of outrage. And it does seem like a lot of time we're so much more strict with actual citizens, and we don't apply the same standard to illegal immigrants.
And that's the topic, or the question that some people are bringing up. So there's lots of sides to that situation out there. But some kids potentially would be sent away, being forced into a situation where they need to be immunized. So we'll see how that progresses. Pretty interesting. We have a couple of stories here from our one of our favorite segments, the Of Course This Happened segment, two that are humorous, I guess, or bizarre. This first one is from Yahoo Sports, and they say, we know how much a game-chewed Steph Curry mouthguard can fetch at auction. Somebody found, you know, now just to give the listeners a little bit of a backstory here if you're not familiar. Steph Curry is a pretty popular NBA player for the Golden State Warriors. Two-time most valuable player in the NBA, won the championship a couple years back. And if you've watched him play, he has one of these teeth guards, and he always has it kind of half out of his mouth. He's chewing on it, and my wife hates it. She says, I wish he'd keep that in his mouth.
It's disgusting.
A lot of people feel that way. But somebody found one that he chewed on in a game. He must have tossed it aside or something. It was not the one that he infamously tossed.
Not
at
the one
a
that,
fan.
He overhand launched at a fan at courtside.
This was a different one. Somebody grabbed one and they sold it for $3,190 on an online auction. So somebody paid $3,190 for a piece of plastic that was chewed on and sucked on by Steph Curry. California-based SCP Auctions handled the sale. In June, the vice president of SCP said he expected the mouthguard to sell for at least $5,000. So they didn't quite get the money they wanted. A couple of funny comments to this story. Bob wrote this a few hours ago. Watching Curry chew it constantly during a game, with it hanging out of his mouth most of the time, is bad enough. It reminds me of a baby with a pacifier. Comical when nobody else is having that problem. Anyway, this sale tops the stupid list. One more comment here. This other person says, the only logical reason I can think of for this purchase is that it is someone trying to clone Steph Curry and they need traces of his saliva to make it work.
It's technically an unused mouth guard because he never has it in his mouth for the purpose it was made for. He drives to the basket with that thing hanging out of his mouth. That's when you're going to get hit, and he never has it in.
Yeah, I'm surprised that players are doing this. Like when I played in school, I don't remember anyone ever having a mouth guard. Chewing gum was maybe the furthest. Or the only thing somebody would have in their mouth that I ever saw or that I would use myself. And for safety reasons, maybe they do need it. But like you say, it's just becoming like a kid's binky.
It really is.
They chew on it and suck it. You know, most parents, when you have children, they want to put pens and pencils in their mouth and chew on them. In most cases, you say, hey, take that out of your mouth. It's a bad habit. Not maybe in every case, but so maybe his dad, because his dad attends the games, and his mom, maybe they need to say, hey, you need to stop chewing on that. It's a bad habit.
There's a commercial that he does about getting rid of bad habits, and his wife puts that on the projector screen in front of this audience and says, well, here's your bad habit that you need to get rid of. And so apparently, he's acknowledged that he does it all the time and that it's gross,
yeah,
but he hasn't stopped doing it.
Yeah, it's such a strange thing to be playing a game that is that intense with that many big, quick, fast athletes and wanting to have this big piece of plastic hanging out of your mouth. It just seems like it'd be dangerous. Like you could choke, get it pushed into your throat or something.
Yeah.
I hope that doesn't happen for him. But anyway, this is one of those things that a lot of people don't like looking at, but now some people want to buy it, and they're willing to pay a little over $3,000 for it.
Yeah, I always wonder why athletes want to have something loose in their mouth while they're playing. Baseball players have a gigantic pouch full of sunflower seeds just tucked into the corner of their mouth, and they're running full speed to catch a ball or running around the bases full speed. I guarantee you I would choke on those sunflower seeds. I'm not going to keep them in the corner of my mouth so perfectly. It just seems so risky to do stuff like that.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting what people will spend their money on to have a piece of the sports memorabilia.
It's going
to
hurt him at some point. He's going to choke on that thing.
One other story here from, of course this happened, Kentucky Fried Chicken, one of our favorite establishments.
Yes.
They just unveiled a new product. Are you ready for this?
Yes.
Chicken-scented sunscreen.
Yes.
So, of course, when you're out there on the beach tanning or wherever, you want to smell like chicken. KFC is launching an unexpected new product, fried chicken-scented sunscreen. Starting Monday, the chicken chain is giving away 3,000 free bottles of Colonel Sanders Extra Crispy Sunscreen. U.S. residents can receive the SPF 30 by visiting extracrispysunscreen.com. You can get this for free. Suntan lotion always smells like lotion, KFC CMO Kevin Hochman told Business Insider. So we thought, why not make it smell like fried chicken?
That is a scent that makes people happy. People just haven't thought of it being a scent that you'd put on yourself. But if it is a scent that draws such a positive response every time someone smells it, I mean, we have to get outside these norms for our scents.
Yeah, it's so interesting, to have somebody come up with that epiphany. It always smells like lotion. Well, yeah, because that's a pleasant smell. They could make it smell like other things, but the company will be giving away the sunscreen on a first-come, first-served basis while supplies last. There's a limit of one bottle per household.
So at the restaurants?
No, you have just to go to, you have to visit extracrispysunscreen.com.
Oh, yes.
So write that down, and that's going to be on Monday.
Okay.
So, and I got to tell you, I kind of want a bottle.
I'm doing it too.
Just
yeah,
to
I'm doing it.
Know what it smells like. It's such a bad idea that I've drawn to it.
We'll probably both be converted to it.
Yeah, well,
just put it on for fun.
It'll be great. Well, if you've ever watched that show Seinfeld, which we occasionally reference because it had some humorous moments, there was an episode where one of the characters in there was suntanning. He put like butter on himself.
Oh.
And his neighbor, Newman, who is a portly fellow, he kept smelling the butter and looking at his neighbor who was all suntanned, and he kept envisioning him as a chicken. And he was having to battle this image. And so that's what this makes me think of. That, you know, you're going to be, you know, I can't imagine a situation where you'd want to have somebody around you say, boy, it really smells like fried chicken. And you're like, well, that's me. Is that a positive? I don't think it is.
I don't know. I mean, I just feel like if people like the scent so much, why not at some point just put it on you? And then just be the source of people's joy as you walk around and people are smelling it.
We'll see what happens. I mean,
maybe a car freshener, that you know, air freshener for a car. That would be a good idea because at least then it's not on you.
Well, if you can't get the sunscreen, all you have to do is buy a bucket of that chicken, go to town. You'll smell like it for a while.
Rub some of the oil on your arms too.
Yeah. Oh man, the things you're coming up with—it's really interesting. So we'll see if this takes off, and we could have the lotion on. We could be eating a Whopperito. Just
that's coming still. That's coming.
Yeah.
We have to make sure we do that and review that documentary about.
Oh yes,
the Nazi secretary,
A German Life. Yeah. So if you want one of these three free bottles of Colonel Sanders Extra Crispy Sunscreen on Monday. You have to be a U.S. resident. You can go to extracrispysunscreen.com. And if anybody gets one, tweet us a picture of it. Be interested to see that. You can tweet us at KPCGFM.
So only three, huh? Really? You said there's three free ones out there?
Oh, no, sorry. 3,000.
Oh, okay.
Maybe I said three.
I got my...
Sorry.
That dashed my hopes for a second there.
Well, still, it's not a lot. 3,000 free bottles. If you're in the U.S., you can go to extracrispysunscreen.com and one per family. So stock up now while you can.
At the strike of midnight, I'll be up. I will 12 o'clock 01, I will send that email.
Their website will crash. Yeah. So, of course, that happened. That's something being unveiled by Kentucky Fried Chicken as the world turns. More important things to discuss. Make sure you listen for the Key of David program coming up today here on KPCG. And if you'd like to watch the videos of the Key of David program, you can find those online at thetrumpet.com. We have quite an archive going back quite a few years. And you can see those videos there, as well as the Trumpet Daily program, the video programs, and, of course, the radio shows as well. All of that's available at thetrumpet.com, and you can hear the audio here at kpcg.fm. 101.3 over the air as well. The Trumpet Daily radio show is coming up in a bit also with Stephen Fleury from Edstone, England. Talked about a few things today. He mentions a prophecy in Luke 21 where Christ talked about the times of the Gentiles. The Gentile nations are rising up against the retreating U.S., one of the examples he highlights is Russia and Iran. Russian jets were taking off from an Iranian base, and which is interesting because they are not natural allies. They don't necessarily get along, but they have a common enemy in the United States. And so as he points out, as these Gentile nations are rising, the U.S. is retreating, and some of these nations that are not really allies, because, I mean, Iran and Russia fought for quite a few years. They're not natural allies, but they do have a common enemy in the United States. And that's really being a fulfillment of what Christ talked about there in Luke 21.
That should be alarming to a lot of Americans, too, that these nations who have fought each other and disliked each other for a long time still regard America even lower on the friends list and will bind together just to put America down. And that's what we're going to see pretty soon, is a lot of nations allying with each other. so that America can be overpowered.
Yeah, it's interesting because the more the current administration has reached out to these Gentile nations, these traditional enemies of the U.S., and tried to be their friends, I guess, the more they hate us.
Yeah.
I even saw a headline, I think it was last night, where somebody was warning the U.S. that, look, Iran's going to try to take more hostages, so be on the lookout. So the more we go to them, the more they're like, yeah, sure, we'll take whatever you have to give us, whether it be money or whatever. And then we still hate you, by the way. We still think you're the great Satan. And we just kind of keep plodding along and turning our back on our allies. It's, if you weren't here living through it at this time, you wouldn't believe it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it makes no... Like, if you went to a college classroom and you were being taught, how to operate foreign policy, and they laid out this plan for you, I mean, you'd think it was a joke.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Try to turn your back on all your allies, befriend your enemies, give them everything, and they still hate you.
I think it would be interesting if the instructor described it that way and didn't say this was how the Obama administration was handling things, and people said, well, that's crazy. And then they say, well, did you know this is exactly how America's doing it right now? Because that, I don't think a lot of people even realize what's going on. People are just so ignorant here of world events and foreign policy. That is what we're doing, and no one has been more blatantly disrespectful toward an Israeli leader than Mr. Obama has. Iran calls us the great Satan, and yet somehow we think we can change their viewpoint. That's such an extreme viewpoint. There's no shaking them from that, no matter what we do.
Right. I mean, their objective has always been get the U.S. out of the Middle East and destroy Israel.
Yeah.
And then, of course, they have some other thoughts in there, too, I'm sure, but those are some of their big goals, and they're not turning from that at all. So, and really, we've capitulated and withdrawn from the Middle East, and it hasn't made them friendly.
Yeah, we're actually helping them with those goals. We're actually helping them dominate the region and speed up their goal to bomb Israel, which is what they want to do. As soon as they get the firepower to do that, they'll do it to Israel, and obviously they're going to try to do it to America too. Those people are lunatics.
Yeah, yeah, that's absolutely right. It's just funny to hear somebody say that, but that's true. They are. You don't hear that in the mainstream, but that is absolutely true.
I probably triggered someone else by saying that.
That's right. Also talked about on today's program is children. Modern society doesn't restrain children in a proper way, a loving way, teaching them do's and don'ts. Pretty much a lot of cases let them do what they want to a large extent. Just let them go. Let them figure it out. And the fruits of it are terrible. And so he talks about that as well. I mean, a topic like that a few years ago would be, probably along the lines of, letting a kid watch as much TV as they wanted or something along those lines, which would not be a good idea. And that's still not a good idea. But now we're getting into things that are just bizarre. Letting them choose their gender identity. It's like, what is happening? Mm-hmm. It's gone from bad to worse.
Yeah, let them choose to riot. Let them choose to support a communist political candidate. I mean, there's just all these crazy things that young people are doing now, and the indoctrination starts early. I mean, parents may not even realize it's going on, but it starts even before they go off to these liberal universities.
Right, because of just kind of a let them go sort of a upbringing, and it doesn't work out very well. So those are some of the topics talked about on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show today. Make sure you listen for that coming up here in a bit on KPCG, or you can join the multiple thousands of people who like to download it at SoundCloud and or kpcg.fm and listen to it there. Take it with them whenever they have a chance to get in a listen to that program. That's coming up here in a bit on KPCG as well. You can find our schedule online at kpcg.fm. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, take a look at this really interesting article from The Atlantic, The Obsession with Biblical Literalism. There's a theme park in Kentucky that's focused on some of these biblical events. It's pretty interesting. We'll look at this write-up right after this on Trumpet Radio Live.
We'll be right back to Trumpet Radio Live. You're listening to Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG. KPCG is supported by the Philadelphia Church of God,
The PCG produces thetrumpet.com, a news website analyzing current events and Bible prophecy. Thetrumpet.com includes daily updates, analysis, and a unique perspective based on the Bible. More information is available online at thetrumpet.com.
Welcome back to Trumpet Radio Live here on 101.3 KPCG. Online, we have a live stream at kpcg.fm and a link there at thetrumpet.com as well. This is Trumpet Radio Live, the Tuesday edition. Dwight Falk and Grant Turgeon with you here today. And it's you remember Woodstock? Well, we don't remember it because we weren't alive. Yeah. But you're aware of it, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was the music festival back in the day. Varying opinions, I think, about the value of that.
I've heard nothing but bad things about it, personally.
Yeah, it's bizarre, to say the least. But every once in a while, they try to get it going again. I think a few years ago, they tried to have one and try to rekindle some of that nostalgia or whatever. Well, they're going to have another one, apparently, but this time it's basically for black people. And it says that this is T.I., who is a Grammy award-winning rapper, actor, entrepreneur, husband, father, and an activist. So quite a long list there.
Yeah.
He announced that they're going to have this music festival, and it's kind of a music festival, but it's also sort of a cultural, I guess, festival, but also promoting different ideas that they have. And so he's going to join fellow musicians John Legend, Common, Public Enemy, Carlos Santana, and more at the Many Rivers to Cross Music Festival. That's going to be October 1st and 2nd, just outside of Atlanta. Yeah, they're doing it on my birthday. I wonder if that's any it's just a coincidence.
First or second?
The second.
Okay.
And they talked about this show, and they said that it's going to be multicultural, but mainly black. And they said it's important for our listening audience right now to just realize with this festival, it's time for black people to get, I will say, angry. He said something else. To get angry about being taken for granted. It'll be interesting to see what comes of this. They said this is, they describe it as sort of like a multicultural but predominantly black Woodstock. So there you go. Interesting just to see the times in which we live. And, you know, we always, of course, I think everybody hopes some of that dissension quiets down a little bit, but it seems like it just keeps rolling along. This is an interesting write-up here, Grant. It's from The Atlantic. It says, the title is The Obsession with Biblical Literalism. A Christian theme park in Kentucky brings the ancient to life through a life-size reconstruction of Noah's Ark, but not without, as they say, dipping into fiction. What do they have to say about this?
So I actually, at first I started reading this article because that quip there that you just read made me upset, them saying that it dipped into fiction.
Yeah.
And it does kind of start off like they are looking to scoff at this recreation of Noah's Ark. This woman quotes Voltaire, who said, no story requires more faith than Noah's Ark. He said, the history of the deluge being that of the most miraculous event of which the world ever heard, it must be the height of folly and madness to attempt an explanation of it. So you have to kind of be insane to believe it or to try and explain that it really happened. So this is a tone that the article began with, but the facts actually do show that there are some embellishments, because we know that the biblical account of a lot of these huge important events is pretty brief. They have to sort of add some details to it.
So they have, apparently, and they've kind of just kind of gone with their imaginations a little bit.
One part of it describes Noah's son Shem's wife. So Noah had a son named Shem. Shem's wife, they called her Kezia, which is a made-up name because the Bible doesn't even mention the ladies' names, I don't believe. But it says that Kezia enjoys dressing up nicely, but the Ark's busy schedule doesn't usually allow for it. So it kind of like had a description of each of the people on the Ark and their different hobbies, which the Bible does not bring out. But it did make it a pretty interesting interactive display.
So, yeah, that is an interesting thing. I wonder how many people have gone there. I think I have read about this park before a little bit,
yeah,
in passing, and it is something that people, I mean, are obviously interested in. in some cases. You know, it's funny, though, too, because thinking about, you know, some people being kind of scoffing at it. And, of course, now if they've embellished, that's another story. But just the idea of the ark itself, I thought, well, actually, that would really tie into what the Bible said because they scoffed at it when he was building it the first time. So
it's kind of proving the point of the entire story and the lesson that Noah's story has. That's a good point. This article talks about how there's a big trend now in evangelical thought. It's a fundamentalist realism where people are actually reading the Bible and believing the words that it says,
right.
Which is not how it's always been.
Yeah, right. Which is, and of course, you know, you do need to have some understanding of some history there and some of that prophecies as well, some of those prophecies as well. But right, I mean, even if somebody just sits down and just takes it at its word, you can learn a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And the world would be a much better place if people just even just attempted that.
Yeah,
just sat exactly. down and said, "Well, you know, look, here are the commandments. Here's what they say. I'm going to try to do this."
Mm-hmm.
That would change things.
Yeah. So this actually is a pretty positive trend that we see here. This life-size exhibit, this replication of Noah's Ark, has over 100 exhibits on it, and it goes into great detail to try and explain how each difficulty could have been surmounted. How do 8 people who survived the flood feed 2 of every type of animal? This display shows that they did it through an elaborate system of drains and chutes. What about the stench of all the animal waste? Solved easily enough. Noah just needed a ventilation system powered by the tides. And he could also dispose of the waste with a type of treadmill conveyor belt powered by elephants. Huh. So a lot of pretty creative ideas for how this could practically work. Obviously, we don't know exactly how the inner workings of the ark went about, but there are some ways to explain it. So at least that way, if you're having trouble believing it, this could maybe even strengthen faith.
Yeah, well, but the other thing too about it is, the thing people have to remember is that, you know, God pretty much designed it. So, you know, it could be that we just don't have quite that expertise.
Yeah.
But even if you just look at humans and some of the things that they discover that were built years ago before what we would consider modern technology, they have a hard time figuring out how they did it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how did they make the pyramids? How did they there's other things that like in Petra. There's some structures that were made, and they try to figure out, well, how did they make that exactly? So, and some of the things that they don't think they could replicate.
Yeah, right.
You know, and so it's there were some very, very skilled people then. It's easy to think of that time period as like people just kind of roaming around and, you know, trying to figure out how to, you know, do basic things. But in a lot of cases, I think they were highly skilled, probably more skilled than we are today. And we're just a little too self-assured to realize that.
That's a good point. Yeah, if we didn't have all these advanced tools, there's no way we could build some of these things like the pyramids. I mean, I don't think we'd be smart enough to figure out a way to do that. The thing is, with a lot of these different structures, people can be critical all they want to of how they were built, but the reality is the evidence is right there. They're actually standing today like the pyramids. And even they found some evidence of Noah's Ark being a true story. I think we talked about it with some of the, I believe, the silt from the top of the mountain actually being at the bottom or something like that.
Yeah.
And that couldn't happen unless there was a huge flood that went from the top of the mountain and dragged it all down.
Right.
This article goes into great, or the display goes into great detail with how do you fit elephants on the ship? Well, they were babies at the time. If you doubt that a wooden ship carrying all this cargo could withstand an apocalyptic flood, there's a placard that explains that the ship's dimensions, as specified in the book of Genesis, have been proven by naval engineers to be the perfect compromise between comfort, stability, and strength. So actually, practically, the ship could have withstood a flood. It also has a display where there's this screen you can look at, and it shows all these other type of ship designs that have been used throughout history, and it actually shows the ship falling apart and sinking, and it even lets you hear the screams of the people who are dying in the flood. So it's a pretty graphic display. And of course, the only ship that survived that kind of flood was Noah's Ark.
Yeah, fascinating. And again, you know, obviously they had a guess on a lot of it, but you know, at least it's an attempt, I think, to maybe, you know, make it a little more realistic for people. So in a way, it's kind of neat. I think it'd be fun to at least look at.
It sounds like a really well thought out exhibit, even if they do take some liberties to try and liven up the details that we don't know. I mean, pretty much every movie does that of any type of historical account anyway. You can expect that and then just look back at the Bible for the parts that are truly accurate, the things that we know for sure.
Yeah, it is. It would be interesting for people to check that out if they're in that area, in Kentucky there. So you can look that up more online. It's at The Atlantic, The Obsession with Biblical Literalism. And do they have the name for the exact name of the park?
Ark Encounter. That's what it's called. Yeah.
Ark Encounter.
Ark Encounter.
Yep. So you can check that out if you'd like to. Sometimes those are kind of neat to see what they've done. I went to a water park called Noah's Ark one time. Not wasn't related that much other than there was a lot of water slides. So.
Noah's Ark, huh?
A little different, yeah.
Wow, they literally named it that.
Yep, they put a little tiny ship there, and you just rode around on the slides. So, but it was a lot of fun.
That's great.
They used to claim it was America's largest water park, but I think it's been passed about 1,000 times.
It used to be big, though.
It used to be quite impressive, especially when we were kids. So that's pretty interesting right up there at the Atlantic. You can check that out if you'd like to. This is Trumpet Radio Live. Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon with you here today. Some interesting stories here in relation to health. One of them, a quicker one here, is that trampoline parks, they're pretty popular. A lot of kids like to go to those and jump around. But they're saying it could be an emerging public health concern. It says trampoline injuries result in nearly 100,000 emergency room visits each year, more than 90% of which occur in kids under 16. Broken bones, spinal injuries, fractured skulls. Those are just a few of the complications children have experienced from jumping on trampolines. Now, trampolines, of course, are a lot of fun, but over the years, I think they've been somewhat dangerous. Even people having trampolines in their backyard, it seems like that's always been an area of concern, having to be careful to not get hurt. If you've watched, say, America's Funniest Home Videos at some point, you always typically see at least one or two videos of somebody falling off of a trampoline. Can be somewhat funny, but of course it can be pretty serious as well. They say U.S. emergency room visits due to trampoline park injuries increased from 581 in 2010 to a whopping 6,932 in 2014, while visits from home trampoline use remained the same. And it's probably because there's more trampoline parks, and that's what they think, according to the article. So if you're heading out to one of those trampoline parks, which are a lot of fun, and by the way, you can burn about 1,000 calories an hour, too, in case you want to bounce around a little bit. But you have to be careful out there. Watch yourself and other people, too. So trampoline parks, a lot of fun, but got to be careful when visiting those and enjoying that activity. Well, this is an interesting write-up here from the Washington Post. The title is Mission Creep Doesn't Benefit Patients at the End of Life. This is written by Samuel Harrington. And he says, when my father was 88... and the picture of health for his age, he taught me, an experienced physician, an unexpected lesson. The author says, we were discussing treatment options promoted by his primary care physician and other doctors for an aortic aneurysm, a ballooned segment of blood vessel at risk for dangerous rupture in his abdomen. He turned to me and asked, why would I want to fix something that is going to carry me away the way I want to go? And he says that his father had a pretty good impression of what would happen if the aneurysm ruptured, that he would not live long after that. And so there was some pressure there to keep him alive longer than what he would have lived if he had some medical intervention. And so, like, he asked his son there, well, why would I want to keep living? And his son had some, reasons. He said, you could see your grandchildren. You could spend more time, with family and those things that people do like. And so there was a little bit of pressure there. And but despite the generally decent health that his father had, the author says we both thought that he was too old for a major surgical repair. So I suggested he undergo an outpatient procedure to insert a stent to prevent the ballooning artery from worsening. And so that point, he'd be able to live a little bit longer, but it wouldn't be as majorly invasive. And he could likely enjoy the birth of his first great-grandchild. And that was something that, of course, he was looking forward to. He says, the author says, my father lived 5 more years and met 12 great-grandchildren. So that was pretty exciting. But then he says, 3 of those years were good, but 2 of them were not. The author says, I've asked myself, was it worth it? I know that he asked himself that too. His mantra for the last 2 years of his life was, I have lived too long. And so it's interesting to look at this. Older people, of course, start to have health problems at some point, to some extent. And the question comes up, do they try to extend their lives with medical treatment, or do they let nature take its course? And in this case, they're talking a little bit more about very invasive medical treatment. Not that you know, they're talking so much about just some basic help or something like that. They're talking about more invasive operations and procedures that keep somebody going a little bit longer. And what happens sometimes, as in the case of the father of this author, is that he lived too long, he said. He had years that were pretty bad because he had lived too long, as he felt. The author says that there was a 2003 book called Tyranny of Treatment, and it documented the terrible medical procedures used back in the 18th century England, and they get into some of what they did, and it's pretty unsavory, so I won't mention what it is, but they got into quite a few things back then, and you can look into that if you're interested. But they thought it was the best treatment at the time, and yet it was pretty gruesome and not really necessary. The author says, painful, futile treatment continues to this day, particularly with elderly patients who often are not informed of the difference between just having some care that would basically minimize pain and help them in their last few months, or those that or the other option of having invasive procedures. What's the difference? How much longer will you live? What would the quality of life be? He says often they are not informed about the benefits of letting some conditions run their course. And then he says, you know, in America here, there's this deeply held belief that advances in medicine will eventually, you know, cure everything. And people sometimes are trying to hold on for that. And they're trying aggressive treatments. And they think maybe by, you know, if they can live another 2-3 years, maybe there'll be a cure for the disease that they're facing. The author says, this is one reason that every year more than 75,000 people older than 85 die in intensive care units, seeking care that proves to be futile, according to a 2004 study, and why more than 65% of our senior citizens die in institutions when a significant majority say they would prefer to die at home. So there is a lot of people, as he said, 75,000 people older than 85 that are going through pretty rough times at the end of their life in intensive care when they would prefer to be at home. And so it's a really interesting write-up. The author says the impulse to treat often prompts us to forget that many elderly patients have multiple medical problems brought on by chronic organ system weaknesses. Focusing aggressive therapy on one serious diagnosis can complicate another to the point of death, disability, or prolonged hospitalization. So they go in and they try to fix or help the one main area that's causing problems, and then it taxes the other systems, and there's another problem. The author says, beyond that, too many doctors succumb to research from drug and device makers that show incrementally positive results for therapies that mean little to someone at the end of a long life. And here's a really good example that he brings out. He says, a friend recently told me about her 89-year-old mother's consultation with an oncologist for a stage 4 cancer of the pancreas. The doctor launched into a description of some new treatment options. Now, she's 89 years old, and she has stage 4 cancer. After listening carefully to what the doctor offered, the patient posed this question. How long can I expect to live if I decline chemotherapy, and how much longer can I expect to live if I undertake therapy? What's the difference going to be as far as how long will I live? He says when the doctor responded that the answer to both questions was 3 to 6 months, she cut short the consultation. They were giving her her options, 89 years old, stage 4 cancer, and if she went through a pretty intense therapy, chemotherapy, which would have made her, of course, very ill, she would have lived maybe 3 to 6 months. If she did nothing, she would have lived about 3 to 6 months. And so it's a really interesting write-up. Again, it's from the Washington Post, and it's by a doctor. who had his own life experience here with this, Samuel Harrington. And the title of it is Mission Creep Doesn't Benefit Patients at the End of Life. It's interesting to think about because people obviously get to that point. And what decisions do they make? And there's a lot of pressure. There's a lot of fear. If you were to believe all the commercials you see on television that we all see, there's miracle drugs out there that somehow will make everything great. But the reality is they don't do a lot, especially for people that are older. And what they do a lot of times is make that time that they have to live even worse. It's a really interesting article to read. I think it's a good perspective. Again, from the Washington Post, something to think about as a man tries to solve more and more problems and yet isn't having a lot of success with it. Washington Post, Mission Creep Doesn't Benefit Patients at the End of Life. If you get a chance, maybe check it out. We covered some of the highlights, but there's more there, and it's a pretty interesting perspective from somebody in the medical profession and dealing with a family member as well. So pretty good write-up, and I think worth considering. Thanks for joining us today on this edition of Trumpet Radio Live. Have a great rest of your Tuesday. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Thanks for spending some time with us. Myself, Dwight Falk, and Grant Turgeon. Enjoy the rest of your day, and we'll see you back here on Wednesday. You're listening to Trumpet Radio here, 101.3. We're KPCG online, kpcg.fm. Live link to trumpet.com.
You're listening to Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG.